MediTalk with Dr. Ross Walker.
And as I said, he normally joins us each and every Tuesday afternoon. We always look forward to talking to Dr. Ross. I wasn't here yesterday, but he agreed to fit us in his busy schedule this afternoon. Thank you for that, Ross.
It's only because you're a good mate of mine.
How are you, mate?
I'm fine, thank you.
That's
I'm
good.
Extremely busy healing the sick.
Healing the sick. I've got a couple of emails from some people that have sent in questions. They're good questions,
yep.
They are. Good questions.
Sure.
And look, I'm sorry, but life got in the way. I didn't send them to you, but I know you're very good at doing this, so let's go. All right?
Yep.
This is from Sarah. Sarah said, I always find that coming into winter, my nose starts to burn and I sneeze a lot. My eyes also sting. I know these are usual allergy symptoms, but I never have a problem in spring. Would you ask Dr. Ross what I can do to help this?
Yeah, look, I'm not really sure what the underlying cause for this is, but I still think it's some form of allergy. See, the weird thing is that although the cold has some benefits, the cold can still affect local immunity in the upper airways and in the lungs. And the reason why we get more respiratory infections during winter is that the hair cells, like you've got these little things like tiny brooms in your lining your bronchial tract that just basically dust out all the mucus out so you cough it out. And those hair cells don't work as well in winter because of the cold. So someone who's getting a burning nose and sneezing and eyes stinging is almost certainly getting a problem with local immunity in the upper airways. What I would suggest in this situation is certainly a good antihistamine. So there's a lot of good non-sedating antihistamines on the market if people want that. If they want to sleep a bit better at night, you can take something like Zyrtec, which helps you sleep. And there's a couple of supplements that may help as well in this situation. So quercetin, spelled Q-U-E-R-C-E-T-I-N, one of those twice a day. There's a preparation, garlic, vitamin C, and horseradish, one of those twice a day. And fenugreek, 1,000 milligrams twice a day. So you don't have to do all of them. You just do one at a time and see if that helps. And I think a combination of just doing those things may help. With the eyes stinging, there's some over-the-counter drops you can get, vasoconstrictor drops. You talk to the chemist about that. That may help there as well. I don't think there's any magic underlying disease or diagnosis we can make here. I just think that's an overview of the situation. You manage it as best you can, and when winter stops, you can stop all the stuff.
Okay, thank you, Sarah, with an H. I dare say I would thank you as well. This is from Dan. Dan said, I have struggled with severe dry skin for years, but it gets significantly worse in winter to the point where I can't even wear long sleeves or pants. I use a pretty heavy-duty sorbolene cream, but it doesn't help much. Is there anything you can recommend?
Well, firstly, when anyone has something like this, you always got to look at what medications they're taking, because sometimes the medications can make it worse. And so they might have been on a blood pressure pill or a statin for a long time. And by changing that, a lot of these symptoms may get better. The reason why things tend to be worse in winter is exactly the sort of thing that I was saying. You get a lot more vasoconstriction in your skin. So when it's cold, your blood vessels clamp down so you don't get good blood flushing things through. So that's why this tends to happen worse in winter. But short of going to see a dermatologist and getting a proper diagnosis, why do people have dry skin? There's a thing called ichthyosis where people get scaly skin with it as well. But all you can do is manage it locally, as he's doing. The sorbolene cream is a good way of going. But getting a firm diagnosis with a dermatologist is a one-off thing. It's not a bad idea. So it's good to go and see, because they know a hell of a lot more about skin than I do. And you can't actually, on the radio, see someone's skin and know exactly what's happening.
It would be a bit hard. It would be a bit hard. Mary says, is there anything, Dr. Ross, that I can add to my diet to help with body cramping?
Well, there's no foods you can take that are going to help cramping, but there are things you can do. If people are just getting occasional cramps, again, it gets back to what medications are they on, because the evil statins, no, I'm only joking, but statin drugs can certainly cause cramping. So 20% of people who take statins get problems with muscle pain, stiffness, weakness, cramping, and in some cases even loss of muscle bulk. So if someone's getting cramping, I always ask them, are you on a statin? Also, if someone's getting bad cramping, I want to know what their electrolytes are doing. What's their sodium, potassium, calciums, magnesium, all of these things? Because if they have a problem there, that can make them cramp. and you just, if you just throw over-the-counter stuff at people who are getting cramping and don't make a diagnosis, you often miss it. So thyroid problems can cause issues there. Problems with B12, folic acid, iron deficiencies can sometimes cause cramping. Iron deficiencies are more commonly associated with restless legs. So if people are getting really bad restless legs at night time, the first thing to do is check their iron levels and see what's going on there. And when you check iron, you do iron studies and ferritin, because just a serum iron level doesn't tell you anything. You have to look at the whole profile. But if all those things have been checked out and nothing's found and people are just getting cramps, the things that they can add, natural things, are ubiquinol, the active version of coenzyme Q10, so it's 150 milligrams, probably taken in the afternoon because it's going to affect, people tend to cramp more at night time, and some form of magnesium taken twice a day can get into the muscles and help things. Now, if people are still getting very bad cramping, there is a drug called biperidin which helps, and in fact, good old tonic water has a thing in it called quinine, and quinine's actually very good for cramps as well. So maybe I'm not suggesting a gin and tonic, but maybe a bit of tonic water at night time. And if the people are diabetics, well, probably I'd suggest the artificially sweetened tonic water, because there's a lot of sugar in tonic water, but that may help as well.
Okay, thank you. And last but not least, from Anne. Anne said, I recently had weight loss surgery. Since then, I have lost over 25 kilos. Well done, Anne. But I also seem to be losing quite a bit of hair. Yep. I try and eat my recommended protein. Is there anything else I should add to my diet?
Yeah, the problem is, when you do have weight loss surgery, you don't absorb a lot of supplements as well. There are some quite good hair, skin and nail products on the market that may help. There's also some local things you can put in your hair if you're losing hair, such as the Regain 5%. You just put a mil in the hair twice a day. That may help as well. And sometimes there's even some medications that are necessary. But I think if someone's had significant weight loss surgery with a significant weight loss, they've probably got a bit of micronutrient malabsorption, and that needs to be readjusted by all the things I said. So hair, skin and nails, try that. Try some Regain and maybe get a full evaluation with your doctor to make sure you're not lacking some nutrient.
There you go, Anne. Thank you, Ross. I tell you, he's the best in the business, isn't he? He had absolutely no idea about those questions we were going to throw at him, but my goodness me, detailed answers. That's why we love Dr. Ross. Best in the business. Let's talk about vitamin D. Vitamin D intake could reduce cancer mortality in the population by 12%, provided the vitamin, as in vitamin D, is taken daily.
Yeah, this was a really interesting study out of Germany where they looked at 14 different studies of vitamin D intake, 10 where they took daily doses, daily low doses, 4 where they took higher doses but only once a week. And they found that there's some really interesting things came out of this study. 15% of German adults are felt to have a pronounced deficiency of vitamin D, which is quite not a shock, because in the Northern Hemisphere especially, where they don't have the same sort of sun that we have down here in Australia, they don't get the good dose of vitamin D. Now, they did another sub-study where they showed people with colorectal cancer, so bowel cancers, 59% of these people were vitamin D deficient, and those who were vitamin D deficient had a much worse prognosis compared with those who had normal vitamin D levels. But in 10 of the 14 studies where they had daily low doses, and we're talking average dose of around 2,000 international units a day, which is what I suggest everyone takes, there was a 12% reduction in cancer mortality in people taking the daily dosing. And see, the interesting thing there is that, and a lot of people don't realize this, it takes one cancer cell 9 years to become a 2-centimeter tumor, then it takes 6 months after that for it to double to about 2 kilos worth of tumor. So because of what we call the tumor doubling time, so there's an exponential increase in tumor size when you've had cancer. And so what they're suggesting here is that the vitamin D is probably slowing the cancer down rather than stopping people getting cancers.
And people don't really, I suppose, think about how important it is, and correct me if I'm wrong here, Ross, but when you have your blood tests, if the doctor says, okay, it's time to have blood tests, and I know my wife and I do it once every year,
yep.
It's really important that you say to your GP, could you please also include in that vitamin D, please? Because most GPs, I think don't put a vitamin D in there. They put the sugars and cholesterol and all those sort of things, but they don't put vitamin D.
Yeah, can I say, however, in defence of my general practitioner colleagues, and I think it's a very difficult job to be a GP, in defence of my colleagues, one of the problems is that the government comes down hard on doctors, especially GPs who are over-ordering tests.
Right.
And this is the problem, because the government's got all these computers that looks at every test that's ordered. So if GPs do too many vitamin D levels on their patients, they get counselled and possibly pulled up before the medical board. So I say to people, look, have a vitamin D every few years, but don't have it every year. And just say you have it, nothing much has changed in your life, you're taking your vitamin D capsules every day and your vitamin D's around 100, well, I wouldn't bother having a check for another 5 years, unless something dramatically changes in your life. So I don't think we should be asking our doctors to do too many tests, because they get into trouble for over-servicing, I can tell you.
Data from a recent study suggests that people with asthma and atopic dermatitis may be at a higher risk for developing osteoarthritis.
Yeah, and you wonder, what the hell's the connection here? Well, there's an interesting set of white cells called mast cells, which are really important in the generation of allergic phenomena. So people that have asthma, atopy, like urticaria, things like that, eczema, hay fever, as we've just been speaking about before, or even anaphylaxis, have what we call a type 1 allergy. And the mast cell is very important in releasing all these dreadful histamines into the system. That's why antihistamines block all this stuff, and therefore can induce bad asthma or eczema or whatever. So they took 117,000 people with a history of these type 1 allergies, compared them with just over 1.2 million people who were in the control group, and they found that people who had a history of asthma or atopy had a 58% increased risk for osteoarthritis. So you say, well, where's the link there? How on earth can an allergy lead to arthritis in the joint? Well, they found that there was a high concentration of these mast cells in the joint as well. So it could be what stimulates the mast cells to produce the histamines that cause the asthma and the atopy also stimulates the mast cells to release the histamines and all these other what we call vasoactive substances into the joint to set up inflammation and damage to the joint. So there you go. So you say, well, what do we do about it? Well, I'm not suggesting that antihistamines are going to treat arthritis, but what I am suggesting is that once you've got a common mechanism, you can use specific therapies directed at the mast cell over and above antihistamines, because I know that antihistamines have never been shown to prevent arthritis. So in the future, we may be able to treat arthritis and also look more carefully for arthritis in people who have a history of asthma.
Right. Okay, a capsule that captures the first look inside digestion in healthy people. It's called the CAPSCAN capsule, and it can open a valve at specific points in the digestive system to collect fluids and all sorts of things. The technology enables the first study comparing the small intestine and colon in healthy people. This is out-of-the-world stuff.
Yeah, well, you see, you and I have been mates for years, and over that time we've spoken a lot on this segment about the importance of the gut microbiome.
Yeah.
The problem is, if you go and give a stool sample to your local pathology place, all they do is map the DNA footprints of some of the bugs in your bacteria, and we really have no idea what's going on in the gut microbiome, because different levels of the gut have different concentrations and abnormalities in bacteria as you go down from the stomach down to the anus. So what they're talking about is that if you really want a comprehensive look at somebody's gastrointestinal tract, you really need to go all the way through it. So when you have, say, a gastroscopy, they put the tube down the throat, the gastroenterologist is really only looking at the very most down to the end of the duodenum. You can't get much further than that. So you don't see the rest of the small bowel. So you're missing probably about 3 or 4 meters of small bowel. And then with a colonoscopy, you look the other way up. But I can assure you that the all the gastroenterologist is looking for when they do these tests is either things like Helicobacter in your stomach or polyps in your colon. They're not looking at the microbiome and assessing how that's affecting it. So in this particular study, they only looked at 15 healthy patients, but they found that there were 2,000 metabolites in the gut. There were so many different species of bacteria, and looking at how these things affect our health. So I think we're just at the very rudimentary stage of this, but we're getting to the point now. This is really future of medicine stuff, but possibly in 20, 30, 40 years' time, we'll have toilets at home that will assess our microbiome when we pass feces and, you know, things like that, and be able to give you then feedback as to whether you have a healthy microbiome or not. So there are all these things that are being developed as we speak that are going to be somewhere in the future. So this particular capsule, you do have to collect it in your stool, so it's not a pleasant thing to have to do, but I'm saying we are getting better to understanding what's going on in our gut with these sort of techniques.
Now there's a job. What do you do for a living? I'm a stool capsule collector.
Yes, well, I knew a friend who went for the chair of gastroenterology, but they gave him the stool instead.
Boom, boom.
Boom, boom, yeah.
A peanut patch. This is in medical news. A peanut patch worn on the skin may help protect toddlers who have potentially life-threatening peanut allergies. This is good news.
And this was published in the New England Journal of Medicine, so, you know, it's a pretty rigorous trial. 362 toddlers aged 1 to 3 were given either a patch or a placebo, and the patch had in it microdoses of the peanut protein, and they found that after 12 months, 67% of these kids were able to consume between 1 to 4 peanuts without any reaction at all, compared to 33% in the placebo. So what this is saying is that kids with peanut allergy, still a lot of them grow out of it, but some of them are still stuck with a dreadful situation. We all know the occasional tragedies we hear of when poor little kids are exposed to peanuts and they have this severe anaphylactic reaction. So we're getting closer to being able to treat this.
Fantastic. My time is up. I've got to go to the news. I'm going to have to let you go. Firstly, thank you so much for swapping days. We appreciate it. We'll talk to you next Tuesday, all things being equal. And thanks, mate, for answering those emails. We appreciate it too.
My pleasure. Lovely to talk to you, mate.
As always, you have a nice weekend. See you, Ross.
Same to you.
Bye-bye, mate.